You're listening to Last Word Radio, where you get the last word.
Power play on the Last Word on Sports, Last Word on Hockey Radio Network. I'm your host, Ben Kerr, and normally this is where I say with me, as always, is Dave Gove. Unfortunately, we haven't been on for a few weeks. You guys obviously know that. Dave has moved on to do some new things with his educational career, with his schooling. Doesn't have time to record the podcast anymore. That's unfortunate. We leave it on good terms, though. I'm sure Dave will be back as a guest at some point on the podcast, but just doesn't have time to do it with me every week. So I spent a few weeks soul searching, looking for a new host, and we didn't know what to do. And then the hockey gods came to me, and they sent me a blinding blue light. And in that blue light was my new co-host. So welcome this week on the new On the Power Play show with Ben and Colton, our new co-host, Colton Prale, the managing editor of Last Word on Hockey. Colton, how are you doing tonight?
I'm wonderful. I think you're exaggerating the blinding aspect of that light, but you know, it's fair to say you are in awe of me, if that's what you're getting at.
All right, yeah, we'll go with that. For those who want the bigger story of the blinding blue light, they can check out Connor LaPalme and Jonas Wielden with the Last Word on Hockey podcast. You were a guest on that yesterday, and they went into the story of Colton's blue suit. So for regular listeners of our radio little podcasting station here, they may have heard the show. If they haven't, go and check it out. They do a good podcast as well.
Certainly worth a listen.
All right, Colton. So we're doing our first podcast here, where they do Last Word on Habs. We kind of do at On the Power Play a wide range of stories from around the NHL. But our first story and one of the biggest stories of the week just happens to be out of Montreal. We've seen Carey Price back for two games now. He's let in one goal in those two games. He had over 35 saves both nights. Is this a return to the Carey Price of old? Is this a sign for Montreal fans that they have the best goalie in the world back in their net and things can start moving up the standings now? Or is it too early to tell? What do you think?
I definitely think it's a little too early, but I would hedge my bets that this is actually the return of Carey Price. I mean, let's be realistic here. It's Carey Price. You know what you're getting with him, and it's not what you've received the past couple months. His save percentage is rebounding sharply, and he looks like himself more now than he has this entire season. So I would, cautiously, of course, but I would hedge my bets that Montreal's getting the goalie they just signed to a $10.5 million deal.
Yeah, I think Carey Price looked great the first game of the season against the Buffalo Sabres, and then never looked fully right after that. He had another good game against Florida at one point before he got hurt. But even then, even the Florida game, he didn't look completely right. And a lot of goals on his blocker side, a lot of problems with his lateral movement side to side. And he says he got injured in the Minnesota game and then sat down afterwards. But I know that there were a number of commentators who were out there. It wasn't just me saying that he didn't look like himself, even on the goals that were going in. He just didn't look right. And I think what we've seen in the last two games is a calm and a composure in Carey Price, an ease in his movements side to side. There isn't that stuttery, jerky movement when he goes cross crease. There's a very fluid movement, very calm and composed movement. And that's almost his trademark and what you see from him when things are going well. So I think he really hasn't been healthy all year. He got healthy, And it took, you know, it took 3 weeks off the ice to do it. But now that he's back, he seems to be 100%. And I think that that bodes well for the Canadians, who are a bit of a flawed team and need that type of goaltending behind them.
That's just it. I mean, this is a team in a division that's wide open. And if you can bring back a Carey Price, and we're talking actual Carey Price, not, you know, a quarter or a half or three quarters, we're talking 100% healthy Carey Price. If you can bring someone like that back, your playoff chances go through the roof, at least in the Atlantic. Because realistically, we're looking at what, 5-3? You know, if you're really thinking about that. And Montreal has a real chance to be in that three with Carey Price. Without, I think they're just another team in the Atlantic.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think with a healthy Price, I mean, we've seen them with, we've seen this story before. We've seen them be a 100 point team four of the last 5 years. And the 1 year they weren't was they were a bottom feeder, and Carey Price missed 4 to 5 months of that season. So we've seen this story before. We've seen the difference that his goaltending makes to the Canadiens team. There may not be a single player in the league who's as valuable to his team as Price on his game is to Montreal.
I completely agree with that assessment. You know, maybe in years past, you could have said Sergei Bobrovsky, but you know, in the league as it stands right now, even Corey Schneider doesn't fit that mold anymore. It really is Price.
Yeah, and especially with this defense, the way it's currently constructed without PK Subban, I think that that was a downgrade. Without Andrei Markov on the back end, without the puck moving that's back there, it exaggerated the need for the strong goaltending.
And that's just it. I mean, we spoke about that on the Last Word on Habs podcast as well. It's just there's really no excellent passer on that blue line anymore. You know, there's no excellent breakout skater anymore. There's good ones, but there's no game breaking one.
Yeah, that's completely the issue. And they need a lot out of Jeff Petrie. They're asking the last few games, especially even with Shea Weber out of the lineup, more than what Petrie can give on a consistent basis. Don't get me wrong, he's been great the last two games, but that's not something you can expect from Jeff Petrie to do for 60 plus games. They're going to get Schlemko back, so that will be a little bit of a help. But there's no Andrei Markov, there's no PK Subban, there's no top 10 defensemen in the league like both those guys were. Markov in his prime and Subban taking over from him were for the Canadians for so many years.
Here's a question for you, and I'm totally springing this on you, mostly because I know how you feel about the player. Do you think the Habs miss, to a certain extent, Nathan Beaulieu?
Nathan Beaulieu is such a polarizing player.
I know.
he can look dynamic. He can look like an all-star. At one point, you know, I had him very high in my draft rankings the year he went out. I had him 9th overall in that draft rankings. I loved the way he played in his draft year in junior. And then it's like he never progressed. He still made the same bad passes that a 17-year-old makes that usually most 17-year-olds grow out of. Mm-hmm. He made the same bad pinches, but at the same time he could put up 30 points because he would make some dynamic plays. So I think Schlemko was meant to be the answer and the replacement for Bouillon. I have a whole theory about the Habs defense this year. One is that Schlemko was supposed to replace Beaulieu, and he has been hurt and hasn't played yet. So let's see how that goes. The second is that Alzner was the upgrade on Alexi Emelin. And the third is that Marc Bergevin really thought he was going to get Andrei Markov signed at a discount deal. And when that discount deal didn't happen and things dragged into August, he's got his second pair defenseman. He's got his third pair defenseman who's been injured, but he never got his guy on the first pair. And then it became a scramble to say, What have we got in 19-year-old Victor Mete? What have we got in Mark Streit at, you know, 100 years old? What can Joe Morrow do is what we're looking at in recent games. Jakub Jerebek is also being pressed into duty, and it's almost like the guy who was supposed to be beside Weber just is over in Russia right now, and Bergevin doesn't know what to do.
I completely agree with that assessment, and I think David Schlemko will work out. I'm a big fan of his. I really like his game for what he is. But that's just it. I mean, he's not going to solve all your problems. He is the tertiary upgrade, you know, that makes a team better, but doesn't break the team.
Yeah. I that's why I said, I feel like he's the upgrade on Beaulieu, and it's not, I mean, it's still not going to, solve the biggest issue that defense has, which is a partner for Shea Weber.
I thought Jordy Benn would work out better, if I'm honest. I liked his game in Dallas. I really expected more.
I feel like he's a five. Play in the top four for injuries, but he's not, and he's not the guy to play with Shea Weber, because he's almost like he's the poor man's Weber. Like, they're the same style of player.
Yeah.
That he clears the front of the net. He throws his hits. He's got an okay shot from the point for what, I mean, he's not a Canadian Olympian and that, but Weber really needs an opposite beside him, a guy that can lug the puck up the ice and rush the puck and make those smart plays, do what Ryan Suter and Roman Josi did for so many years beside him in Nashville. And he doesn't have that in Montreal.
Yeah, I should have prefaced that with, in no way do I think Jordy Benn should play top two, even top 3 minutes, but maybe a 4 or 5, you know?
And he's gotten better the last few weeks. He started off the season really slow. He's playing like a number 4 or 5 right now.
Well, maybe I misread him.
he did have a tough start, though. So that's what's going on in Montreal. Down the road, we should probably preface this. Everyone knew Dave was a Kings fan. We know that your team at heart is the Ottawa Senators. And down the road in Ottawa, they've got a little bit of a losing streak going on. Things haven't gone so well since the Matt Duchene trade happened. What is going on with that trade? Why did it take 8 games for Duchene to get his first point as a Senator?
I'll preface this with, it should have taken 2. All right, he was robbed of an assist on the second game in Sweden, but the question is valid, you know, and it's more than just Matt Duchene. It's the entire team. It's tough because they don't really look like the Guy Boucher team of last year, which, unless you watched a ton of them, you'd probably think is pretty boring. They're definitely more run and gun this year. And they had a certain extent of that last year, but it was more of a counterattack. You know, they would press the puck quickly, you know, allow shots from the outside. And when they got a chance, they would spring. And there's not a lot of springing. And there's also not a lot of shots to the outside anymore, or at least that no longer seems to be the theory. There was a still a few days ago from their penalty kill. And it's literally just 4 Senators standing still on the blue line as the forecheck breaks into the zone. And that, to me, perfectly sums up what this losing streak has been. They've been a team that lacks a system, that hasn't been good on special teams, and that's getting cycled on repeatedly because they play the world's most passive box in the defensive zone. And, you know, none of those are markers of a Guy Boucher team. All of those are indicators that either they're not paying attention to his system, or they're not listening to his system, or he's lost it. And I think it's a little early for him to have lost the room. So I really don't know what the answer is for what's wrong with the Senators in a systems answer, other than they're just not playing it. I mean, there are certain players who you can point to who have been abysmal. You know, Craig Anderson, for example, has been just awful from the start of the year to now. He has been awful, and it was masked because other players had a fantastic shooting percentage, like Mark Stone. But, you know, he has not been good this season. I think the other thing, and I come back to Guy Boucher here, is the lines. You know, Duchene has not played on a really consistent line, and he's been all over the place. He can't get into the team's top line, which is fair. Brassard, Hoffman, Stone all play incredibly well together, you know, but eventually you're going to need to give him opportunities. I'd really like to see him with Mark Stone. As I said in the Last Word on Habs podcast, that's a player who just makes everyone else around him better. And if you can offer that to Duchesne, I think maybe you can jumpstart him, but then you're sacrificing your first line. So I really don't know what the answer is. I don't think it's the crazy line matching that Boucher has done. I really don't believe that's the direction this team should be going in.
I think a lot of people want to see Duchesne and Bobby Ryan together. Unfortunately, Bobby Ryan hasn't been in the lineup lately, and that's created a bit of a gap in the second line. And then you take out Zach Smith as well, and it really weakens the wingers who could have played with Duchesne.
I completely agree. I mean, having Zach Smith back in the lineup is huge. Don't get me wrong. And I think when they've worked together, Duchesne and Ryan have been interesting and creative. But, I mean, he's playing with, for the most part, Bobby Ryan and Ryan Dzingel, which, like, let's be honest, it's not an ideal second line. You know, maybe 5 years ago. But now they're not the same caliber of player. You know, at least Ryan Dzingel is fast and can skate with Duchesne, but, you know, we're stretching for upsides here. He really needs some quality people to play alongside of him.
Yeah, that's seems to be one of the issues. One other thing that I think is going on with the centers, you talked about them not following the system, them not maybe Guy Boucher doesn't quite have their full attention. Not saying he's lost the room, but they may have a little bit of a lapse from him. Is they were playing so well to start the year, and they didn't have Erik Karlsson in the lineup. They were working so hard to win without Karlsson. And there's a natural tendency, and I think a lot of teams do this, when a star player is out of the lineup, to really play well, to be on your system, to everyone else pitches in, and it's a hyper focus to really maintain your level without that player. That star player comes back and that hyper focus is still there for a little bit. And then a few games in, it starts to wane and it slowly just drops off because you kind of expect your star to carry you more. And it's a natural human reaction. I don't know if there's any stats on it, but it's something that I have noticed in a lot of teams. And then usually once a losing streak kicks in, at some point the team wakes up and kicks it. But I have seen a lot of teams when they get a star player back are good for a few games and then slowly go into a tailspin.
I definitely buy into that. I think there's a change in mentality, you know, when that occurs. And you know, while we talk about star players, I think it is fair to mention that Erik Karlsson has not looked like Erik Karlsson at all. You know, he's not coming back at 100%, and anyone who says they think he is hasn't been watching him, because he doesn't look like the Norris winning defenseman he is.
Now, is that because of the injury? Is he ever going to be 100%? I mean, he had some pretty major surgery, from what I understand. They took out part of his ankle bone.
Yeah.
To me, the fear is that Erik Karlsson becomes the defense version of Peter Forsberg. And I know you remember how Peter Forsberg's career ended, but he had a foot that just would not sit right in his skates and would not sit right in his boots. And they tried custom boots and they tried all kinds of things with him after he had those foot problems, but he just could not find a skate that was comfortable. Is that a fear here with Karlsson?
I don't know if it's a comfort level in the foot so much as it is just an inability to do the same actions as he could before. You know, I'm not sure if it's an issue where the skate changes it so much as it is like he's literally just missing part of his ankle and as a result moving side to side and those lateral hops and like frequently crossing over and cutting and putting all your weight on that one foot while you're on your edges is just something that I'm not sure he is going to be able to do again to the same degree he did. You know, maybe this heals up and we laugh about this in a couple months' time. But if it doesn't, it's a serious concern because he's getting turnstiled in a way that he just didn't before because he can't cut across the ice like he used to.
And it's only a matter of time before teams get that on film and recognize it and see it enough times over and over that everyone's going to be attacking him the same way. It's such a copycat league. It's such a league where video coaching and advanced scouting is so important that it's not something you can hide.
And the issue is teams are already starting to do it, not necessarily because it's Carlson, but because the scouting report on Ottawa is don't come down the right side because they're left D pinch. You know, if you're coming down the right board, Mark Borowiecki or whoever's playing there is stepping from his blue line to center ice to try and lay a hit on you to force you to dump it in. So they're already starting to take the Carlson side, and it's just a matter of time before they blow by him. If this keeps up, I should preface that.
And I don't want to be too alarmist with Carlson. It may just be a thing that he's at 80% right now and he will get to 100% and he will be the Carlson of old. But I guess anytime you're missing, I've heard anywhere from a quarter to a third to a half. I think
it's 50% of his ankle bone.
Yeah. And anytime you're missing that, I can see where the issues lie, but again, it may just be learning how to adapt with what ankle bone he has left, and he may be able to do it. I wouldn't put it past him because he has been one of the best defensemen in the world in the last decade.
Yeah, I mean, he's a smart player, and he's a workhorse. Like he heals really, really well. I think my biggest concern is he becomes Milan Lucic, or not Milan Lucic, sorry, Milan Mihalik, with the knee surgeries and then constantly re-injuring that portion of his body and never skating the same way.
Yeah, that, that's a fear. I just, like I said, I heard the foot not being the same shape and same,
yeah.
And my mind goes to Peter Forsberg and when he played, he was dynamic and he was still a huge scorer in Philadelphia and Nashville. He was still a huge threat when he was on the ice, but he just couldn't stay on the ice enough. The strange skating would create problems elsewhere in his lower body, whether it be hips or knees, and it just slowly took its toll on him.
That I think is the biggest concern. It's just, you know, how does this affect the rest of them? And with, you know, plyometrics and yoga and flexibility training, the hope is that, you know, they can work past that, but it is definitely a concern.
All right. Another Canadian team giving their fans some concern early in the season is the Edmonton Oilers. Now, Edmonton had a fantastic season last year. Connor McDavid was the league MVP. They finished second in their division. They won their first round. They gave a 7-game battle to the Ducks in the second round. And people said Connor McDavid 1 year older, Leon Draisaitl 1 year older. The Oilers continuing to improve and get better. This is their year to challenge for a cup, and they are well back of the pace right now. Looking up at a playoff spot, can Edmonton turn it around, and what's going on there first of all, and can they turn it around?
I think part of the issue is a lack of chemistry, honestly. If you look at their 5-on-5 lines, Connor McDavid, Leon Draisaitl, Pat Maroon has played 203 minutes together. Now obviously that's no longer a line, but the next most used line is 61 minutes between Lucic, Hopkins, and Ryan Strome. You know, like, when you're constantly juggling players up and down, it takes time to get used to how someone else plays. And when your third most common line involves Kyler Yamamoto, who's no longer with your team, there's a bigger issue. You know, I mean, I think what we've got right now is just a coach who's trying everything and who's making it harder on his players. And it's combined with the fact that they can't get a save from Cam Talbot, and Oscar Klefbom is having the biggest struggles of his career. I think it's just a
it's two bad
disasters made worse by a coach who isn't sure how to fix it and is just trying anything and everything.
There's a lot going on there. They miss Andre Sequeira. They really, you know, they're really missing a top four defenseman there on the right hand side.
I mean, Chris Russell, 4x4, now playing third pair minutes. You know, they brought him in to be that guy. He was never that guy, but they brought him in with that intention. And now that they realize they don't have that, you know, what do you do?
I mean, Chris Russell had a good season for them last year in a very limited role in doing what he was asked to do in playing a defensive game in limited minutes and maybe making a first pass out of the zone and blocking his shots. But he's always been the guy. I remember the season, the year before when he signed the one-year deal with Edmonton. You know, it was the joke among the hockey analytics community is who's going to give this stupid five-year deal to Chris Russell?
Mm-hmm.
And no one did, and everyone resisted it, and that was great. Then the Oilers gave him the one-year deal at cheap money, and I was okay with that. I was like, you know what? He may not be an analytics darling. He may not be worth 5 years, $20 million, but he can still play in this league, and he can be used in sheltered minutes at low money on the third pair and be just fine. And that's what they did for a year, and then they saw him be just fine in that role. And somehow they forgot that he's a failure as a top four defenseman, that he can't do that. And they decided to pay him as a top four defenseman and use him as one. And we're seeing the results right now.
It baffles me. GMs frequently baffle me, but GMs with regards to Chris Russell baffle me more than anything else.
Yeah, I mean, everyone saw this coming. It was seen a mile away by the entire analytics community on Twitter. There was almost no one who was on the sign Chris Russell bandwagon. Even the people who really hate analytics and are all eye tests and this, I saw them being like, Chris Russell's really not as good as what the contract he is going to get is.
Mm-hmm.
And then he never got that deal. And he played decent for a year, and then he got the deal. And it is mind-boggling, especially for a team that's going where you can see where Edmonton was headed and where the cap crunch was going to come.
Yeah.
I don't know why they thought, you know, $4 million on Chris Russell. I just don't get the thinking of that at all.
I think that's part of their issue. Is all the money they have tied up in guys who aren't going to help this team in the near future. Obviously, it's not their immediate issue, but it is the issue.
Yeah. And Milan Lucic, I mean, I can understand where Chiarelli fell in love with his Boston Bruins player and the guy who helped him win a Stanley Cup and the new age power enforcer winger and how he was going to fight on and protect McDavid. And I always thought it was a stupid contract, but I could understand the logic behind it.
That's fair.
I couldn't understand I just can't understand the Chris Russell contract whatsoever.
Yeah, no, I'm completely with you. And I think the idea of the new age power forward is definitely a topic of discussion for another podcast, because I think it is a thing, but I don't think Milan Lucic is that player.
Not now. He was. He's not now. He was at one point, yes. I think that type of player, you've got to be careful. And we can do a whole podcast on it, but I think one thing you've got to be careful with that type of player is term.
Mm-hmm.
Even no, more I
completely,
so.
Completely agree. What about the Oilers' back end? You know, have they overestimated some people? Darnell Nurse?
Yes, I think they thought Darnell Nurse would be ready for a bigger role than he is at this point in his career. Darnell Nurse, I still think, can be what they want him to be, but not in the way that they're handling and developing him right now. It's not going to work, and he's not ready for the prime time top 4 minutes right now. He needs a steady partner, a veteran beside him, someone to learn from and to, you know, maybe not be used in the last 5 minutes of a third period protecting a one goal lead. that might not be the best time for him at this stage in his career. As he gets experience and as he grows as a player, he certainly will be that defenseman, or could be that defenseman. I won't say will, I'll say could be that defenseman. And that would work out. But right now he's not that player, and they are asking too much out of Darnell Nurse at this point in his career.
I completely agree. The other player I think they're asking too much out of, Ryan Strome. I think they grossly misjudged the kind of player he is and the kind of player Jordan Eberle is.
Well, I see why they made that move. They needed to save the money on Everly's deal and get it lower to where Strome is. I think the next casualty in Edmonton is an obvious one, and that's Ryan Nugent-Hopkins.
Yep.
I think that by the start of next season, he will be in a new uniform when that McDavid contract kicks in. There's just no way around it. Someone's got to move, and no one's taking that Russell deal, and no one's taking that Lucic deal. So the guy that has to move is going to be Nugent Hopkins, and they should be able to get a decent return for him, because there's so many teams that need a top six caliber center that you're going to have a bidding war for him.
I know you and I have talked about this. Ryan Nugent Hopkins as a center is not really a number one. He's a comfortable middle six forward, and I'm okay with having him as your second line center. But do you think teams will be eager to give out the assets that I'm sure Shirelli is going to want for a guy like Ryan Nugent Hopkins? Because he's going to command a pretty penny.
Well, you just look. I think it's a supply and demand thing. Mark Bergevin is desperate for a center. Mm-hmm. Jarmo Kaikkalainen is desperate to find a center. Nashville seems to have addressed that issue. They're no longer, I don't think, in the running for it.
Yeah, I think they're okay.
I think Ottawa is going to hang their head on this Duchesne deal. But I think the Blackhawks would love a center, but they don't have the cap space to do a Nugent Hopkins. That's not going to be a question. But there may be some other teams. Right now, it looks like Montreal and Columbus are the two who really will be battling for Nugent Hopkins services. And if you can set up some type of auction and bidding war between those two clubs, you can get some nice pieces, I think, if you're the Oilers, and pieces who may come at a good salary cap hit. As much as I'd hate to see him go, a guy who would fit in well in Edmonton and given his cheap contract is Brendan Gallagher.
Yeah. Yeah.
A guy who I think the Oilers might be after in Columbus would be a Ryan Murray and perhaps a Josh Anderson up front to help them on the wings. That might be something that could interest the Oilers.
Yeah, I think you're hitting Peter Chiarelli pieces on the head with Ryan Murray and Josh Anderson.
Yeah, so I mean, those are the two teams that I think will be in that mix. I don't know if there will be a third at this point. I've heard the Lightning are looking for some more scoring depth, but I think they look more for a winger than a center. Knowing what they have down the middle with Braden Point and Tyler Johnson and Steven Stamkos. I think they're more looking for a winger to put with Tyler Johnson. I'm not sure where else you look for a center. I mean, the Oilers would never make a trade with the Flames. With the Flames, are going to have to either re-sign a Backlund or make a move there for their number two center. And I'm not sure.
Praise Sam Bennett changes.
Yeah, praise Sam Bennett remembers how to score that he scored in junior. But there's only a few real contenders who are going to have the cap space and the need. And right now I narrow it down to Columbus and Montreal off the top of my head, really.
No, I think they're the two obvious choices for where he winds up. And I know Nick, the other managing editor on Last Word on Hockey, just wrote a decent little article about acquiring Ryan Nugent-Hopkins for the Blue Jackets. And he looks into how he could help and where he would fit. And I think he did a good job evaluating it. I think he maybe undersold some of the pieces going back the other way, but can't blame him for that.
I think he's might be giving up a little bit more than what was offered in that piece. But I do think the assessment of Nugent Hopkins is pretty accurate there. The one thing I take issue with, and it's not something that Nick did, it's something a lot of the commenters and people responding to Nick are saying, is, but Nugent Hopkins doesn't win enough faceoffs.
Oh,
you know what? Mark Scheifele doesn't win a lot of faceoffs, and I would take him on my team in a second. Yep. And Evgeny Malkin is a 40% faceoff guy, and Logan Couture is a 40% faceoff guy, and it just does not matter. If you can play with it, it's all about being able to play without the puck. And if you can play without the puck at center ice, then the number of faceoffs you win is largely irrelevant. The difference between a 50 and a 40% faceoff guy is an average of 1 to 2 faceoffs a game.
Faceoffs are important on the power play in the offensive zone and in the defensive zone in the last 2 minutes and just about nowhere in between. You start so many more shifts on the fly at that level of hockey that if you are a better player, like you said, without the puck, if you are just solid positionally, you will be vastly superior to a faceoff expert. And I can prove that by saying, look at Antoine Vermette. All right. He is one of the best in the league at it. Look at Derek Stepan, one of the best in the league at it. Neither one of those guys is as valuable as a Mark Scheifele, as a Malkin.
Yeah, no, exactly. It's all about, and Nugent Hopkins has become a very good two-way player. He's not going to be your number one center, like you say. I don't think he's a franchise guy, but he can play against the other team's best line and do okay and still provide some offense while doing that.
Easily.
And whether he wins 42% or 51% of his faceoffs, those being his career stats and this year's stats, it really doesn't make a huge difference.
Easily. And you're taking what? At the most 30 draws a night? Realistically, you're probably hovering around closer to 15. There's not, like, those are low numbers. The difference between 50 and 40% is like two faceoffs.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. It's like two faceoffs a game. And again, I don't care about the faceoff at center ice, and I don't care about the faceoff outside the blue line on an offside call. Those are some that I'm not even, you know, that are get counted in that 30 that I don't really care about. I'll say offensive zone faceoffs are almost always a little bit more important than what you've said. I'm not saying they're huge, but there's always a good thing, especially on the power play, like you say. But even without a power play and offensive zone faceoff, we've seen some goals come off them. But a faceoff has become glorified because we track it in the stats, and we don't track one-on-one puck battles. And it's basically a one-on-one puck battle.
That's exactly what it is. In my opinion, it's more important what you do in the 5 seconds following that faceoff, win or lose, than whether or not you lost it or won it.
Yeah, and so much of winning faceoffs as well, we see so many scramble draws that are won because the winger comes in and gets the puck. So having a good winger can be the difference between, you know, 48 and 51. I'm not saying it's going to take you from 40 to 50, but it can be the difference between a 48 and a 51% faceoff guy is who's his right winger and how many pucks does he dig out for him.
That's just it. And while we're drawing at, you know, unique examples, we've seen, look at the Habs, we've seen them draw up set plays where they lose the draw and all three forwards rush the guy who's going to win the puck, and then they win possession, you know, like they're.
Yeah, it's such an overanalyzed stat. out there. And I think it's one of the things that analytics is starting to catch up with. Another thing that analytics is starting to happen with, and we're seeing with the Toronto Maple Leafs, is if you do want to win more faceoffs, don't have your center take every faceoff.
Yep.
Have always put the guy on his strong side. Have a winger who shoots right and a center who shoots left, or vice versa, and always take the faceoff on the strong side. And you're going to win about 5% more faceoffs as a team. And if you're really obsessed with those, you know, one or two extra faceoffs a game, that's one way to get them.
I am so shocked that in hockey, it's taken us that long to realize it. I mean, this is a sport that obsesses about strong side D, you know, not playing defensemen on their offside because of how much worse it makes them. And justifiably so, like the numbers back it up. But for a sport that is so concerned about having, you know, the right-handed guys on the right side of the ice, to have people taking weak-sided draws for this long is just, it feels like a dope moment. Like, we should have thought of this.
Oh, we should have thought of this a lot. I remember for so long, seeing in the media and on message boards, and Montreal has four left-handed centers. They need to acquire a right-handed center, even if it's just for the fourth line, because in the last 2 minutes, you want that guy out there taking the face off. If the puck's frozen on the right hand side of the ice, you want the strong side face off guy. And that it never, and I can admit it never occurred to me, but that it never occurred to anyone. Teach your wingers how to take a face off who shoot right.
Yeah. Yes.
like that never occurred to anyone, that wingers who shoot right can take those face offs and be part of face-off practice with your coach who works on face-offs all the time. It boggles my mind that now that we know this, and now that we're seeing teams do it, that no one's thought of this before, because we've always talked about how important the strong side face-off was, but we just accepted that if we didn't have a right-handed center, we had to accept the left-handed guy doing it.
Yeah, we've just done things so, you think about them so straightforward for so long and just never change.
Yeah. So that's kind of an interesting little talking point there. Now, moving on, something else we are seeing in the NHL today is an abundance of goalie injuries. And we talked about Carey Price earlier. I don't want to really get back into that, but we all know what's going on in Vegas. They have been on their fourth string goalie due to injuries to their top three. We had a big goalie injury in Pittsburgh last night with Matt Murray being out for the next 2 to 4 weeks. We've seen a number of different goalie injuries around the NHL this year. Is there something to it? Is it the new streamlined equipment? Are teams driving the net more? Or is this just a phenomenon in a small sample size?
I'm going to hedge my bets on phenomenon in a small sample size, with the exception of Vegas. I mean, Vegas has been a lot of concussion issues. And so with that, I look at teams just driving the net hard and unfortunate incidents happening. But I mean, you look at things that happened like with Matt Murray last night, that those are just the hazards of playing the position. I actually think this is something we'll see less and less of in the future, just because of the way younger goalies are being treated and the, you know, the plyometrics and the Pilates and the yoga and the, aerobatics that they're being put into at a young age, just to encourage strengthening those muscles and increasing their flexibility. I think one of the really important things, I think the next step for hockey, is to really look at how regular actions, particularly for goalies, affect their body short term and long term. And I think that'll be the, you know, what changes things. You know, for a soccer analogy, for a while, Juventus had the best doctors and they were one of the best teams in the world because of that. Or sorry, not Juventus, Milan. If you can bring that into hockey and you can have a fantastic medical staff who keeps players healthy and keeps their bodies in peak condition and works on not just, you know, healing players, but focuses on stretches and exercises that prevent injuries, that'll be the next step. So I think this right now is just small sample size, and I expect it to decrease just as our knowledge increases.
Yeah, I can see that it's a bit of a small sample size. We're seeing all types of goaltenders, whether it be veterans like a Marc-Andre Fleury, who have been in the NHL for 13, 14 years now, or it be the Malcolm Subban, who is relatively young in Vegas. Whether Matt Murray is a relatively young a goaltender, Carey Price is approaching 30 right now. We're seeing it at all ages, so I don't think that we can say draw too much conclusion there. I think we need a little bit more than the 20 or so, 25 NHL games that most teams have gone through this year to say it's a big epidemic. We did see some injuries. Goalies always typically get hurt, though. There always are goalie injuries in the NHL. It's one of the most demanding positions on a person physically. It's a lot of movements that your body is not naturally designed to make and have to take a toll over time, especially if you haven't done the type of plyometrics and flexibility exercises that you're talking about here, that will have an effect. And I think that goalies should be able to stay healthier if this, as the sports science improves.
I think that is, just as a whole, I think that's one area that hockey really lags behind on is sports science and our willingness and acceptance to use doctors to the fullest of their extent. I mean, how many of these team doctors do you see that are actually just doctors? You know, they're just regular doctors from that town who, yeah, they work with the team, but they also have their regular clientele. You know, in other bigger sports, that's not the case. You know, these doctors are specifically for the team and their expertise is in sport and in that sport specifically. Once hockey adjusts to that and really gets behind the cutting edge, and we're starting to see it with some of the guys who wear heart monitors and things like that. But once hockey really embraces that, I think we'll see a change.
Well, there's the soccer, and it looks funny because it looks like a sports bra. But there are the soccer teams out there that have their teams with the GPS trackers tracking their movements all over the field, exactly how many feet and they have run it during a match and how many miles they run during a match and what speeds they're doing, how much is high level exertion and how much is jogging and how much is walking and everything like that to maximize rest and to maximize their training. That's an area that hockey, I haven't heard too many teams getting into, but it is starting. And I think that and so many other areas are there's miles to go in hockey in terms of learning this and maximizing the performance of players.
The only time I've heard of those is when individual players are using it for themselves. There's a guy in the Leafs who does it. I want to say it's Dominic Moore, but I'm not 100% sure on that. But yeah, there's a member of the Leafs who wears it, and he wears it for himself just to match his own performance and see how he's improving and see where he's at health-wise. But, you know, like, why isn't that a team initiative?
Yeah, I mean, it really shouldn't affect performance. They weigh basically nothing. They're meant to be non-restrictive. They're not restricting soccer players. Why would they be more restrictive in hockey? I don't know. And why would they be more restrictive than your shoulder pads that you already wear? It seems counterintuitive to try and argue against them, but you know that there's so much old school mentality in this league still.
Yeah.
And it can drive you nuts sometimes. It's the Chris Russell factor at times.
I completely agree.
So that does happen, and I think that as more and more new thinking comes into the NHL, we'll start to see more and more advances on those things. And the teams that are cutting edge on it will be just like the teams who are cutting edge in analytics. And we're seeing now that the Corsi and things, there's a much smaller gap between the first and the 30th or 31st now placed team in terms of Corsi than there was 7 years ago. And Corsi is no longer as big an advantage in terms of winning games as it was in 2010 and 2011 and 2012. But you know what? Chicago and LA have 5 Stanley Cups to show for it. So the team that that gets on this bandwagon first may have some wins to show for it over the next several years.
Pittsburgh is the reigning champion. They use them.
Yeah, and so there you go. And other than Chris Letang, they haven't had a lot of injuries to deal with in the playoffs.
Yeah. Yeah. And they consistently acquire strong depth, useful depth. Well, I shouldn't say that. They brought in Ryan Reeves, but for the most part, they consistently acquire useful depth.
Yeah. The Penguins are an interesting case study, especially right now. We know they're looking for a center. We've got rumors of Ian Cole being on the move. It'll be interesting to see where he goes. I feel like Ian Cole can be the next Chris Russell if teams aren't careful with him. I think he's a good defenseman, but he's, again, one of those guys who's a shot blocker and does a lot of the old school things well and moves the puck okay, but not great. And at $2 million that the Pens were paying him last year and this year, that's pretty good. But at the $4.5 or $5 million that he may be asking for, it could be an issue.
Yeah, I think the big concern is don't let Ian Cole become the next Ben Lovejoy as far as usage goes.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Well, that's a pretty good first show. What have we got going on at Last Word on Hockey, Colton, to leave our listeners with?
We have plenty going on at Last Word on Hockey. We now have 2 podcasts that we are consistently putting out. We have a number of fantastic articles. I looked at that one that Nick just did. We've got a couple good ones in Pitch. The one I am sadly reading currently is a cause of concern, the Ottawa Senators struggles. Not the article I wanted to be reading, but it's pretty good. It goes in depth. Kenneth wrote this one up. Kenneth Saduku, one of our Send writers. He's pretty good. This one is making me a little upset reading it, but it will be a good one for nonsense fans to read. We've got more coming in. We just got in our great new team manager, John Gove, for the Red Wings. Fantastic guy, fantastic writer. Really looking forward to seeing what he puts out, because I loved reading his stuff in the past.
Yeah, we do have 2 regular podcasts. We hope that this one will make it a third once again, but I know the boys are doing the Habs podcast that you are on. We've got the Fourth Line podcast with Carl, and that comes out every week. That came out yesterday, so take a listen to that. I know that they talked about Gabriel Landeskog being in his 4-game suspension. That was one of their big topics. They also looked at Carey Price, but they did so before the Columbus games. They only had 1 game of Carey Price to look at, and they looked at some fantasy news and some fantasy notes as well. We've also got a good fantasy department look on Mondays and Tuesdays for fantasy tips for the week. And right now, just to kind of plug myself and my own stuff, I've got my November draft rankings coming out. I've got by the time you hear this podcast, we'll have the top 20 up on the site. There's a top 15 up as we're recording this, but I know 16 to 20 is mostly written and just needs a little touch up. So it will probably come out before we finish producing all the audio.
Can we get a little sneak peek? Where does Darlene fall?
Darlene's our number one prospect. I think he's... early in the year when I did my preseason, I said it was going to be a battle between Darlene and Svechnikov. Svechnikov has been every bit as advertised. He's a goal per game player in the OHL before he hurt his hand. But Dahlin has widened the gap. He's just been dynamic over in Sweden playing in a men's league. And as good as Svechnikov's been, there is a bigger gap between first and second than there was before the season began. So I think Dahlin's going to run away with this. I think this is more, could be a battle between Bockfist and to try and make it 1-2 on Swedish defensemen and Svechnikov for that second spot, than I do think it will be a battle for one.
Well, in this year especially, I think you're correct, but I always enjoy reading your depth analysis or depth prospects analysis much more than 1-2, because those are usually pretty covered. But as we go down the list, I get less and less knowledgeable.
Yeah, I think my favorite early prospect, one guy that I'm higher on than I think a lot of other people are at this point, and I think I'm predicting for top five right now, is Oliver Wahlström, who plays for the U.S. National Development Team. He was born in Sweden, but has American parents and moved to the States at a young age, is playing for the U.S. National Development Team, and he has been dynamic as a center for them right now. This is not a particularly strong draft for center ice, but he might be the best centerman in the draft.
Interesting. Well, I'm intrigued to see where in the top five exactly he falls. You'll have to wait and see, though, if you want to find out where he lands.
All right. Yeah, so check out those articles, and check out some to-be-written stuff at Last Word on Hockey. We've always got something new coming down the pipe.
Perfect.
Thanks for joining me, and we'll put out another podcast next week.
Sounds good.
Have a good night.
You too.
You're listening to Last Word Radio, where you get the last word.